I never imagined my grief would lead me into a Starbucks parking lot at dawn, clutching a suitcase that wasn't meant for travel. But that morning in February 2023, under the weak glow of the drive-through sign, I watched a man in jeans and a worn bomber jacket slide into the passenger seat of my car. He leaned in, glanced at the case, and nodded, as if we were old friends trading secrets instead of plotting a murder. He called himself Mike, but he was an FBI informant. He smiled when I handed him the cash, cold bills, crisp with betrayal, and tucked the zipper closed over a plan so twisted it could only have been born in desperation. The target was a former business partner who'd broken us both. The price was $7,000, plus another 24 cleanup. Every detail had been rehearsed. How to fold the body into the suitcase, which backroads to use on the way to Mexico, and where to bury the evidence so nothing would ever tie back to us. Jagninder said the missing man wouldn't be missed, that his family would chalk it up to a disappearance. Ramesh insisted on extra payment for transport. And me, grieving my sister's overdose, drowning in debt from crooked landlords, I saw in their darkness a way out of mine. But it didn't go according to plan. The suitcase never made it past that Starbucks lot. When sirens screamed down the street and uniforms surrounded us, I realized my soul had been the real collateral. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The phone call. I remember the night before it all changed. People like to say grief is a shadow, always there at your back, but for me, it's more like an ache that wakes you up in the middle of the night. A steady, sharp pressure under the ribs. That night, it was after midnight when my phone rang, so loud in the quiet that it startled me upright. I'd barely been sleeping. Insomnia comes easy when your life's been ripped open twice. First by my sister's overdose last fall, then by Ramesh's disappearing act with our money. I looked at the screen, Jagninder's name, glowing in the dark. I hesitated, but answered anyway. I always did. Hello. There was silence, then a heavy exhale. You awake? His voice was thick, hoarse, like he'd been crying or fighting or maybe both. I am now, I said. I'd never admit how much I didn't want to be alone in my thoughts. He didn't bother with pleasantries. We need to talk. About Ramesh. I felt my heart stutter. My grief was already a raw wound, and Ramesh made it worse every time I thought about what he'd taken. It can't wait. No, he said softly. Meet me in the morning. Manteca Starbucks, 7 a.m. He hung up. I lay in bed afterward, staring at the low-painted ceiling. The same one I'd stared at from under my sister's childhood quilt, back when bad dreams were solved by cocoa in the kitchen and my mother's thick arms. But my mother was gone, my sister was gone, and my nightmares weren't stopping for anyone. I got up before sunrise, moving through my tired studio apartment like a sleepwalker. The streets were still dark. I couldn't eat. I pulled on jeans and my sister's old work hoodie, ran a hand through my tangled hair, and told myself, focus. Don't fall apart, not yet. The drive out to Manteca felt endless. Winter mist hung close to the ground, blurring streetlights and headlights into hazy amber halos. I passed rows of almond orchards, their bare branches scrawling shadows across my windshield. The world felt hollow, the way it did since the funeral, like I was an observer, looking at my own life from the outside. When I pulled into the Starbucks lot, I parked next to Jagninder's Nissan. He was sitting inside, engine off. Ramesh's truck was a few spaces over. It took all my strength to step out of my car. The air stung my cheeks and made my eyes blur. Jagninder got out. He looked different. Older. Sunken eyes under messy black hair, day-old stubble, jacket zipped to his chin. We'd grown up together, but lately, every time I saw him, I felt the gulf between us getting wider, as if some invisible hand was pulling us apart. He nodded at me. You sleep? Not really, I admitted. He hesitated, then nodded toward the coffee shop. It wasn't open yet. Let's walk a little. We walked between parked cars and the empty strip mall. Our footsteps echoed on the asphalt. He finally spoke. Ramesh is desperate. He wants out. I talked to a guy, someone who knows people. I stopped. What are you saying? He looked at me, eyes dark and flat. There's a way. To make Ramesh pay. To fix everything he broke. I swallowed. Like what, legal? He shook his head. No, you know what I mean. It hit me all at once. What he was actually saying. The The darkness of it, the weight. Why me? I asked quietly. He ran his hands through his hair. I can't do this without you. He trusts you. He needs to see all three of us together. And I can't do it alone. I remembered all the years we'd been close. Friday nights at the River Club, dancing in the rain at Lodi Lake, crying in the hospital after my sister's first overdose. I hated what he was asking. But I hated feeling this powerless even more. Ramesh stepped out of his truck and came over. He was always the smooth talker, the one who could charm anyone, but now he just looked tired. Hair slicked back, eyes darting to the doors as if someone might be watching. Look, he said, voice low. We need to move fast, before he disappears with everything. I met the guy. His name's Mike. He does things. Fixes problems. He's an FBI informant, I whispered, the words sticking in my throat. Ramesh shot me a look. I know. We won't get caught. This guy's careful. It's $7,000 up front. 20 more after. I couldn't believe what was happening. My sister's dead. And you think this'll bring closure? I asked, voice barely above a whisper. No, Jagninder said quietly. But it'll stop him from hurting more people. He destroyed us. I pressed my fingers to my eyes, willing tears not to fall. I saw my sister's face everywhere. In the crease of my palm, in the way the sunrise set fire to the mist over the parking lot. I wanted to scream. Instead, I reached for the envelope. What do I have to do? Ramesh explained, his voice mechanical. Give Mike the cash. Smile. Don't look scared. Don't mention names. Just act like it's nothing. Easy for you to say, I told him, voice breaking. They both watched me, waiting, hoping I'd slide into the darkness with them. I felt the world tilt under my feet. Was it right to want justice, even this way? Was I even capable of real darkness? Or was I just desperate enough to pretend? I took the envelope. Nodded. The sky was lighter, now, peach and silver at the horizon, a brand new day full of rotten possibilities. Later, I'd remember that moment as the edge of a cliff, the point of no return. Once you've said yes, there's no way to unsay it. My sister used to say, desperation is a lonely place. It makes you believe you're falling, when really you've just landed somewhere you shouldn't be. The rest of the day blurred. I went to work at the bank, counting cash for people who'd never lost anything in their lives. I smiled. I said, have a nice day. With every customer, I wondered what secrets they kept under their skin. Who else might be desperate enough for revenge, for release, for one more chance to erase regret? I paused in the break room, my hands trembling. I tried to text Jagninder. What if I can't do this? But deleted the message before I could send it. After work, I drove to my parents' old house. It had been empty since my mother moved to Stockton. I sat in the dark living room, dust spiraling in the beam of my phone's flashlight. I remembered old years' laughter. The way the house used to smell like curry and jasmine on holidays, before everything soured. I wanted to pray, to ask for forgiveness, but my words dried up. Instead, I cried for the first time since the funeral, big, ugly sobs that shook my whole body. I hated myself. I hated the world. But when the crying passed, there was a bitter calm. I would do what I had to do. The next morning, I was back at Starbucks, envelope in my purse, grief stuck in my throat like a bone, waiting to meet a man who could erase someone from the world. My hands shook as I sipped coffee that tasted of cardboard and guilt. I wondered if Mike would see through me, see the fear in my eyes, the regret in my pulse. When his car pulled up, Jagninder gave me a look. That look we'd traded since we were kids, the one that meant, together, no matter how dark it gets. I wondered, not for the first time, if there was any part of me left that was still good. In that moment, clutching my sister's old red hoodie, remembering 100 nights spent trying to save her from herself, I knew. Everything after this would be stained by what I did in this parking lot. But I did it. I stood up, took a breath, and crossed the lot, every step heavier with the burden of what was about to begin. I waited for Mike for an hour that day, hands folded tight around my coffee cup, nails digging little half moons into the cardboard. That old Starbucks on Yosemite Avenue always smells like scorched beans and disappointment, even on the best mornings. I watched the sun creep over the roof of the insurance office next door and burn the fog off the parking lot, but the cold stayed under my skin. The first few cars that pulled up, I watched with dread. Silver Camry, blue Civic, one battered work truck, none of them him. At one point, a mom and her son passed by. the kid complaining he wanted a donut, not a muffin. And for a second, all I wanted was to go back in time, shove the envelope in the glove box and drive away. Pretend I was just any other woman grieving a lost sister, not someone considering murder. But then his car rolled up slow and cautious. Gray Mazda, windows tinted. He parked across from me, texted a single word. Here. I looked at Jagninder. He was already on his feet, giving me a half nod, bracing me. Inside, my pulse drummed quick and wild. Somehow, I made myself walk over, knock once on the glass, try to look like the sort of person who handed off cash for dry cleaning or lost keys, not hired killers. Mike climbed out, older than I expected, with sharp eyes and a scar across his cheek that caught the new sunlight. He waved me to the passenger side, businesslike, barely a greeting. I sat beside him in silence for a long moment. He slid his phone onto the dash and gave me a look so flat I could see my own scared face reflected in his sunglasses. "You got the payment?" he finally asked, barely above a whisper. I slid the envelope between us. My hands shook. "It's all there," he counted, quick, fingers nimble. He didn't smile. "Names?" I kept my voice steady. "We'll call him Ramesh, but he's not the only problem. He betrayed my family. He ruined her." My voice broke. "My sister. I want him gone." That last line was mostly true, or at least, it felt true in the haze of anger and loss. But part of me was just parroting what I'd heard Jagninder say, hoping it would make my grief easier to carry. Mike considered me for a second. "Easy or hard?" I pretended not to understand, forced myself to hold his gaze. He leaned in, voice even lower. "Some people want fast and painless. Some want messages sent." He watched for my reaction. "Fast. Clean," I whispered. He nodded. "You'll hear from me. Don't talk to anyone. Not even family. Even your friends, quiet." "Got it." I swallowed panic, made myself nod. He slid the envelope deep in his coat and started the engine. 10 seconds later, he was pulling out of the lot, leaving me in my seat, lightheaded. Afterward, the world looked the same as ever. A barista restocked bottled water. A man washed his pickup with a jug and a dirty cloth. My stomach was churning. I walked back to my car and sat behind the wheel, gripping the steering wheel like it was a lifeline. Breathed deep, counted heartbeats. I drove aimlessly, winding through Tracy's backroads and strip malls, past the creaky water tower and the farmer's market I used to visit with my sister. Everywhere I turned, memories. The way she'd tilt her head and laugh when I got too serious. How she tried so hard to get clean, only to fall again. Grief and guilt were like roots tangled under my skin. By noon, I was parked outside our old middle school, watching half a dozen kids argue over a soccer ball. For a minute, I let myself remember what life felt like before money, overdose, betrayal. It hurt like hell, and I realized I hadn't really stopped hurting for months, maybe years. I pulled out my phone, read the text from Jagninder. "You okay?" "No, I wanted to write." Instead, I sent. "Done. That simple. That final." He wrote back. "You did good. We'll get through this. See you tonight." The rest of the day was a blur. Work, meetings, numbers. I served customers, smiled too wide, let their trivial complaints wash over me. By the end of the day, my shirt stuck to my back with sweat, and every time I closed my eyes, I saw Mike's face. I wondered if I'd ever sleep again. That evening, I met Jagninder and Ramesh in that same old parking lot. The three of us sitting on the curb with a bag of cold fries between us like we were kids again skipping class. But there was nothing innocent now. Ramesh was pacing, chewing a mint until his jaw clicked. "How'd it go?" I told them, quietly, simply, skipping the details but letting my shaking hands do the talking. Jagninder watched me, his face tight, as if seeing for the first time just how far we'd fallen. "We're in now," he said, not quite a question. "Yeah," I answered. "We're in." There was relief in that moment, and fear, too. Like finally admitting you're lost only to realize you're further from home than you ever imagined. After they left, I sat on the curb and let the night swallow up the regret. Cars hummed by like nothing was wrong, headlights sweeping past, strangers heading home to dinners and soft beds. I thought of my sister, her ashes tucked into a cheap urn in the closet of my apartment, her smile lost to bad choices and worse luck. I promised her, out loud, to the empty lot, I'd survive this, whatever it meant. But as the cold crept in, I wondered if survival was even what I wanted anymore. or if grief had just made me someone who could say yes to anything, because no led nowhere. That was the first day. Night fell, and I found myself alone again. The world outside pressed close against my apartment windows, but inside, it felt like nothing could reach me. I tried to keep busy with chores, stacking dishes, folding laundry, watering the crumbling basil on my sill, but everything seemed hollow. The envelope was gone, handed over, the decision made. Now there was only waiting. My phone buzzed with normal texts, reminders about bills, an aunt sending me a meme, work group chat updates, but I ignored all of them. At midnight, when I couldn't sleep, I walked the block. The streets in my neighborhood always feel emptier at night. Porches vacant, sprinklers hissing somewhere I couldn't see. I thought of voices I'd loved, my sister's laughter, my mom humming in the kitchen. Wondered how people went about their lives while the rest of us carried things too heavy for words. I realized that if I did sleep, I'd dream about the parking lot, the envelope, about Mike's cold, decisive nod. I wondered if, somewhere across town, he was planning already, finding routes, working out details. Was he a family man? Did he have his own ghosts? Or was I just another problem to solve for a payday? The next morning came, and with it routine. Alarm blaring, the sickly comfort of instant coffee, the same walk to the same bank where nothing ever seemed to matter except numbers. Outside the break room, I bumped into Nisha, another teller. Not really a friend, but the closest thing I had. She caught me staring into space while refilling the sugar tray. "You good?" she asked, voice gentle. I nearly broke right there. "Just tired." She watched me for a second. Too smart, always noticing more than she let on. But let it go. I wished I could tell her everything. Ask her what she'd do if the world closed in all at once. And the only way out was through something unthinkable. Instead, I swallowed it the way I always did. At lunch, I sat on the curb behind the bank, scrolling absently through old photos. My sister as a teenager grinning atop a busted bicycle. The two of us on the old wooden pier at Half Moon Bay. My eyes burned. I thought of what I'd done and wondered if I could ever undo it, if I could ever forgive myself. But I knew even then. The story was bigger than me, that the ripples would spread out, break on every shore of my life. I felt it in the silence after my shift, as I crossed the empty parking lot toward my car, teeth clenched, searching every shadow. Later that week, Jagninder called after dark, his voice different now, quieter. "We just wait," he said. "Act normal. If anyone asks, you haven't seen me." The walls were closing in already. The days blurred together, filled with work, avoidance, and the slow, corrosive ache of not knowing what came next. Ramesh went silent. I'd see him in the corner booth at the Punjabi diner sometimes, face pinched, always checking the clock. Sometimes I'd sit across the room, our eyes meeting only once. Just long enough to acknowledge we were both in this, that neither of us could run anymore. 2 days before everything collapsed, I visited my sister's old apartment, knocking on the door just to hear the echo in the hall. I wished more than anything she'd answer, would pull me inside for cheap wine and bad TV. I wanted to tell her what I'd done, to ask if she'd understand. I knew she wouldn't. I barely understood myself. Uncertainty gnawed at me. What if Mike took the money and ran? What if the cops showed up, drawn by some careless mistake? I double-checked the locks at night, kept my head down at work. I felt brittle, stretched thin. I started writing letters to my sister in a blue spiral notebook, pouring out the secrets I couldn't tell anyone, cursing Ramesh and myself, and the empty ache at the heart of it all. On the night before the meeting, the one that would end with sirens, I curled up in bed, clutching her old red hoodie like a blanket. I listened to traffic on the highway, the distant song of an ambulance siren, and wondered, how did we get here? I promised myself that when the dust settled, I'd find a way to make peace, to remember my sister for who she was. Not just for how she left. I didn't sleep. Dawn came cold and gray. My phone rattled once on the nightstand. It was Jagninder. "Today." No other words needed. I dressed like armor, jeans, boots, that same worn hoodie. Drove to Starbucks, checked for police cars. Mike wasn't there yet. The world felt carved out of glass, every moment fragile, ready to shatter. When his car finally appeared, I realized I wasn't hopeful or afraid. I was numb. There was only the ache of grief and the weight of having crossed a line I could never uncross. The morning after the drop, everything felt wrong in ways I couldn't even put into words. Grief, I expected. Guilt, I could swallow. but there was something else, like waking up in someone else's life. I made my coffee, watched the cream snake through the dark, and realized my hands were trembling. I tried counting out 10 breaths, the way they teach you in therapy. It didn't help. Going to work was the hardest. The world demands you play along, even when you're falling apart. At the bank, fluorescent lights glared off polished counters. Nisha caught me spacing out over the deposits. Her mouth opened like she wanted to say something, then closed again. I was so tired of pretending. I counted money, smiled at customers who didn't care what I'd done. Their lives went on. Old women with perfect nails, guys in dusty work boots, mothers wrangling toddlers and receipts. All of them carrying secrets I'd never know. I wondered if it was always like this. If anyone could be balancing on the edge, and no one would ever see it. My phone buzzed at my hip. Lunch. Jagninder's text. I wished he'd leave me alone. Wished but didn't mean it. Sometimes your only comfort is the person who's falling right alongside you. We met at the park behind the bank, sitting on a cold bench where we used to skip class as teenagers. You sleep? He asked, his voice flat. I shrugged. My words stuck, thick and useless. You hear from Mike? He shook his head. Nope. That's good, right? Means it's working. I nodded, but my stomach churned. What if? The words curled up and died. What if this was all for nothing? What if the cops were already watching us? What if we didn't even want what we thought we wanted? He stared at the playground, eyes rimmed red. You ever think about running? I huffed a laugh. Where would we go? We'd carry this with us. For a long minute, neither of us spoke. A dog barked somewhere across the field. I wanted to tell him about the notebook, about the letters I wrote to my sister every night. I wanted to tell him I still hoped for magic. Impossible, desperate hope that somehow tragedy could be undone. But the words stayed locked inside. When I got home, I checked my voicemail twice, afraid of what I might find. But there was nothing. The absence was its own torment. I spent the evening cleaning. It's funny what you focus on when your world is spinning out of control. Dust on the bookshelf, streaks on the kitchen window. I changed the sheets, threw out old mail, scrubbed the bathroom until my knuckles ached. Somewhere in all that I lost track of time. Sometime after midnight, Ramesh called. He still hasn't contacted me, he said, his tone clipped, more angry than scared. You sure you gave him everything? Yes, I whispered, anger spiking in my chest. I did exactly what we said. He breathed heavily. Fine. Just be careful. People talk. That night I dreamt of my sister. She was alive, in some nowhere place. Half kitchen, half hospital, light leaking everywhere. I caught her eye and tried to explain what I'd done. She just smiled and shook her head. Desperation makes you invisible, she said. I woke up choking, tears wet on my pillow. The next day was worse. Each hour stretched longer than the one before. Every car that slowed outside the bank made my heart race. I kept thinking about surveillance. My phone tapped, footsteps behind me on the walk to my apartment. Meals lost their taste. I started skipping lunch, drinking too much coffee just to keep from crying. By Thursday, I couldn't take it anymore. I called Jagninder. We have to talk. We met at the public library, hiding in a corner. We just have to get through this week, he said. If nothing happens, we're safe. I searched his face for comfort and found none. Later, I sat in my car behind the strip mall, weeping into a fast food napkin, the emptiest I'd ever felt in my life. Friday, at closing, something changed. My manager called me in, worried about a discrepancy on a deposit. I handled cash every day, but now every movement felt suspicious. As she talked, I nodded and scribbled a note. Everything is fine, but I could feel my world tipping, the lines between what was real and what was guilt blurring. That night at home, legs tucked under me on the couch, I almost called my mother. I pictured her face, worry lines, tired eyes. If I told her even part of the truth, what would she say? Would she forgive me? I didn't call. Instead, I wrote another letter to my sister, fingers shaking. I'm lost. I'm scared. You always had a way of making the hard things bearable. I don't know how to do this without you. I didn't sleep. I didn't eat. I just waited. All weekend, I jumped at shadows. Neighborhood kids playing football made me flinch. Blue lights on the horizon had me ducking behind the sink. Sunday night, a car backfired down the block, and I curled up on the bathroom floor, breathing hard, unable to move. On Monday, I woke to a message from Mike. 3 words. Meet tomorrow noon. My blood ran cold. My hands shook so hard I nearly dropped the phone. I texted Jagninder. It's happening. One word came back. Ready. But I wasn't ready, not at all. I was more lost than ever, standing on the edge of something that felt like the end of everything I'd ever been. I looked in the mirror and barely recognized myself. Dark circles, hollow eyes, the haunted look of someone who'd crossed every line she'd sworn she'd never even approach. That night, I wrote what I thought might be my last letter to my sister. I told her the whole ugly truth. I begged her for forgiveness. And when I ran out of words, I sat in the dark, waiting for the sun to rise, knowing nothing would ever make things right again. The next day, I put on my best mask, grabbed my bag, and headed out. The world outside was bright and ordinary, the way it always is in the moments before everything changes. The morning I was supposed to meet Mike felt nothing like the thrillers I'd watched late at night with my sister. Both of us curled up on the couch, shouting suggestions at the screen. There was no adrenaline, no pulpy music in my ears, no sense of dangerous purpose. Just a numb fear, so cold and deep that I thought it might anchor me to the kitchen floor forever. For 20 minutes I stood by the sink, paralyzed, watching steam rise from my untouched mug of tea. When I finally moved, it was mechanical. Brush teeth, tie hair, slip on the sweater my sister bought me 3 birthdays ago. The rituals of being alive, even when you wished for the power to disappear. Outside, the world was already awake. Neighbors wrestling garbage cans to the curb, an old man in plaid pajamas sweeping the porch. I drove through streets that hadn't changed since I was a kid. The same cracked sidewalks where we played hopscotch, the same faded murals on the underpass. I tried not to let memories in, but they came anyway. My sister and me, running, giggling, not yet broken. Mike's text said noon at Lincoln Park. Someplace public, plenty of cover. I circled the block twice before parking, then stared at my hands gripping the steering wheel, white-knuckled. Every voice in my head screamed to leave. But I remembered the envelope, the night at Starbucks, and all the choices that had stacked up behind me like dominoes. I walked past joggers, a mother pushing a stroller, old men clustered around a chess table with coffee and muttered jokes. The ordinariness of it all was unbearable. Like normal was for someone else now, and my part was to haunt the edges, hoping no one looked closely. Mike was there, leaning against an oak tree, sunglasses and a faded gray hoodie, hands in his pockets. I tried to read his face, see if he'd changed, if there was any signal that we'd crossed into new territory. But he just nodded at the bench, so I sat. For a minute, neither of us spoke. My heart thundered. "You here alone?" he finally asked, voice low. I nodded. Swallowed. No one else could handle this. He seemed to weigh that. "Plans changed," he said. He moved. "It's not as easy now." I forced myself to play along, to act unconcerned. "What do you need from me?" A small smile, sharp and mirthless. "You ready to be fully in? There's always a way out, but only before it really begins." I hated that word, ready. I'd never be ready, never should have said yes to any of it. But I heard myself say, "Yeah, I'm in." Mike looked out at the playground. "You'll need to move some cash. Not too fast, not too much at once. Make a pattern, not a spike. And if anyone asks, no names, nothing concrete. Let me handle the rest." He told me about burner phones, about code words for emergencies, about looking for tails. There was a strange calm in the routine of it, instructions I could follow. Something to do with my hands, my mind, instead of just feeling my heart collapse over and over again. After he left, I sat for a long time on that bench. Children's laughter floated over, sharp and bright, like shards of glass. I remembered how my sister used to marvel at kids. "They don't know how close pain is," she'd say. "And that's why everything is magic." My phone vibrated, Jagninder checking in again, 3 words. "Did it happen?" I typed. "It started." But I didn't press send, not right away. Instead, I reread the text over and over, sick with the knowledge that each word tied me tighter to this disaster. When I got home, the silence pressed hard. I cleaned the kitchen again, though it was already spotless. I organized my mail, shredded old bills, scrolled through social media until my brain felt like static. I kept my phone nearby, waiting for another message, hoping it wouldn't come and dreading if it did. That night, thunder rattled the windows. I lit a candle and wrote in my blue spiral notebook. I told my sister everything. How Mike held himself like a criminal, but his hands shook slightly. How I hated every second, hated who I was becoming. At the end of the page, I wrote, "If I don't come back from this, I hope you recognize me on the other side." Sleep was impossible. I lay awake, listening to the storm, replaying every word, every look from Mike, trying to guess how deep the trap was. I thought about calling someone, my mother, Nisha, even Ramesh, but what would I say? There are things you cannot voice, not if you ever want to return to normal. And I already knew, normal was gone. In the morning, news broke of a body found dumped in the Delta. Someone no one recognized. Panic ripped through me, cold and feral. I called Jagninder, voice trembling. "Did you hear?" He cut me off. "It's not him." Mike texted. "We're still on." Relief crashed into me with a kind of shame. I felt sick wanting someone to die, sick at even feeling relief or confusion about who, how, when. The days blurred past. Every time my phone buzzed, my heart stopped. I started seeing police everywhere, in marked cars cruising the block, in plainclothes visitors at the bank. Maybe they weren't there for me. Maybe I was just certain they were. I jumped every time a customer asked my name, every time the door chimed. Jagninder started talking less, eyes hollowed, words clipped. Ramesh started drinking hard, missing calls, showing up wild-eyed and reckless. The secret bound us, made us siblings in a kind of sorrow more isolating than grief. We stopped mentioning the why, stopped telling ourselves it would solve anything. All that was left was to wait and wait and watch our old selves slip away. The weekend after, Mike called, his voice different, urgency hidden under layers. "Change of plans." He's spooked. "I need you and Ramesh together. No mistakes." I said yes, like I always did, signing away one more piece of myself. After I hung up, I stared at the wall. My sister's red hoodie hung from a hook by the door, and I wondered if wearing it would protect me, cloak me in some thin memory of a gentler time. I wore it anyway. Met Ramesh in a parking lot full of pigeons and pale light. The city was waking up, ordinary and miraculous in its indifference to what we carried. Ramesh looked terrible, eyes red, hands shaking worse than before. "You think he'll bail?" he asked. "Or rat?" I shrugged. "You tell me. This wasn't my idea." He winced. "No, but we're all in now." We waited in silence. When Mike finally arrived, he was more direct than I'd ever seen, running through timelines, reminders, warnings. "You want out," he said, "last chance. But if you do, you never talk to me again. Understand?" Ramesh looked at me, eyes pleading. I held his gaze, steady as I could. "We finish," I said. My voice didn't sound like my own. It sounded like a stranger's. Mike nodded. "Good. Then here's how it goes." He detailed the plan. A car, a back street, a message that would lure the target. Each word layered pressure until my ears rang with it. When he was finished, he leaned close. "People think they can live with anything. Most can't." He handed me a small burner phone wrapped in tape. "You'll know when it's done." As we left the lot, a new burden tucked pungent and heavy in my jacket pocket, I wondered if anyone saw us and guessed. If there was somewhere, some parallel story, a woman still dreaming she could turn around and reroute every wrong turn, walk backward out of the darkness before the point of no return. But I knew. That was just a story people tell themselves before dawn. It never made it through to morning. When I got home that night, I didn't write in my notebook. I sat in silence, fingers tangled in the red threads of my sister's old hoodie, and waited for the next step. Waiting now was its own kind of punishment, a hollow where hope used to be, echoing louder every hour. I woke up on edge, even before the sunlight crept through my blinds, a light blue and cold, the kind that makes every shadow in your room sharper. I barely remembered falling asleep. My dreams twisted and restless, a mess of telephone wires and police tape, my sister beckoning from the wrong side of a window. I lay still, listening to my own heartbeat, waiting for a message that might tip the world again. The old phone, Mike's burner, black plastic, slick with my anxiety, sat on the table silent. I kept watching it, sure it would buzz and end everything. But the only sound was a neighbor's dog and the distant whoosh of a freight train heading east. Today was supposed to be the day everything finished. Or started. I couldn't tell the difference anymore. I got dressed slowly. I looped my sister's bracelet over my wrist, fingers trembling like I was 12, sneaking out for the first time. I walked into the bathroom, stared at my face. Pale, hollow-eyed, defiant in a way that almost looked like strength. My sister would have laughed. She'd always said I was the tough one when it mattered. I wished she could see me now, though I prayed she never would. Downstairs, my phone vibrated. I jumped. Not Mike, but Jagninder. You ready? A single word back. No, but I slipped the burner into my pocket. I left the house, locked the broken door, and was out in the real world again. Tracy on a Tuesday never looks dangerous. The bakery windows steamed up. Somebody's sprinklers ticked like a clock in the next yard. I drove to the meeting spot early, circling twice before parking at the back of the lot. Inside the Starbucks, the air was thick with old coffee and tension. I sat, tried to read a magazine, pretended I was anything but a co-conspirator. Nisha's voice replayed from yesterday. You good? And I wondered if she felt the storm coming, or if it was just me. The minutes crawled. Ramesh arrived first, hair unwashed, sunglasses on, tight around the mouth. You seen him? He asked, fidgeting with his phone. I shook my head. Not yet. My voice barely sounded. He sat across from me, both of us pretending we were just killing time. Eventually Jagninder arrived, dark jacket zipped high, scanning the room. He texted, he asked. Not yet. Ramesh's leg bounced, rapid and ugly. He said noon. Always noon. Every time we're early, he's late. He'll come. The certainty in my voice surprised me. I'd learned that sometimes the words you need arrive, even if you don't believe them yourself. After a long silence, the door opened, Mike. Exactly as before. Hood up, eyes flicking over us, cool and methodical. He ordered black coffee without looking at the barista. When he finally sat, his body seemed carved from stone. We're moving, he said quietly, no greeting, no warning. FBI's watching here. We get sloppy, they get us all. Something cold slid down my spine. I looked at Jagninder, who mouthed, stay calm. Mike sipped his coffee. Victim 2's address is confirmed, he said soft, so only we heard. The rest is up to you. No names, no messages, no heroics. You get the cash, you confirm the time, and you vanish. Leave everything to me. Ramesh swallowed twice, cheeks white. And after? Mike's expression was flat. You'll know. Then softer. Don't show up again. If you hear from me after today, it's because it all fell apart. Jagninder nodded. So this is it. Mike finished his coffee in silence, then stood, paper cup in hand. Be smart, he said. No one can save cowards. After he left, we sat. Three stones on a riverbank, watching the water rise. Ramesh said, voice barely more than breath. Do you think we're evil? I peeled the label from my cup. I think we're desperate. Jagninder's eyes flicked to mine. Still family, right? I didn't answer. Couldn't. We all got up and left separately, like strangers sharing only a storm system overhead. I crossed the lot, keyed my car, and pressed my forehead against the steering wheel. For a long time I sat motionless, listening to the engine tick cool with the memory of everything I'd done in its seats. Back home, I felt the world shrinking. My mother called, I let it ring. I paced from sofa to window, watched a police cruiser ease by at dusk. I tried to distract myself, TV dishes, pacing, but every part of my life now tasted like metal, like waiting. The next day, headlines blared from my feed. Tracy Mann pleads guilty in murder for hire plot. Names wound together, tragedy mapped for strangers to dissect. My stomach flipped. Faces I knew on a screen, every word confirming the spiral. It said that Shaminderjit Singh Sandhu who pleaded guilty, that the plan was detailed, payment handed off in the open. All of us caught on hidden cameras. There were lines about conspiracy, betrayal, maximum penalty. There was talk of sentencing, the possibility of up to 10 years, and a huge fine. There was no mention of the grief that drove us, only the acts, the facts, the consequences. I threw my phone at the couch, sat down hard, heart rattling my ribs. I thought of my sister. Her overdose was never in the news, her struggle invisible. But here we were, our worst mistakes tabloid fodder, reduced to criminals in the eyes of strangers. That night, I wrote no letters. I sat in silence, letting the weight of guilt pin me in place. I cried until I slept. And when I woke up, there was nothing but the ordinary world again. Except now, nothing would ever be ordinary. Finality. Betrayal. Decisions echo. The phone never rang again. Not the burner, not Mike, not the old life I'd given up. Only a cold, endless silence. Every day, I wake and remember. Whatever happens next is not forgiveness. It's just survival. But it's mine. The days after the news broke moved with a slow violence. A kind of dull pressure that lived in every hour, hollowing my chest and making my thoughts echo. For a while, I barely left the apartment except to go to work or buy groceries. I kept the curtains closed, letting sunlight bounce off dust instead of my skin. Headlines faded, my phone filled with silence, and everywhere that waiting. Sentencing was set for summer. They said it would be open and transparent. But those words meant nothing to me. The only things that felt real were the questions that came at me in waves. What have I done? Who am I now? Can any confession fix what's broken? Or is some damage permanent? People at the bank whispered when they thought I couldn't hear. Nisha stopped asking me to lunch. I caught her watching me, eyes full of worry, but we never talked about it. Some part of me wanted to reach out, to apologize for what I'd become. Another part wanted to disappear forever. My mother called finally. I let it ring twice before answering. Her voice, the same one that used to ground me when storms roared overhead, was softer now, older. "Beta," she started, "I saw the news." I braced, waited for anger, but there was only heartbreak. "If your sister could see you," she paused, and both of us said nothing. "I'm sorry," I told her, the words scraping loose from somewhere deep. She cried then, or maybe I did. It was hard to tell where one person's grief ended and another's began. Weeks slipped by. I wrote no more letters. The blue notebook sat untouched in a drawer, the pages curled and waiting. I tried to lose myself in errands, in watching strangers at the grocery store, in remembering how to be invisible. One afternoon, I stood at the mirror, tracing the new lines in my face, the way grief and shame had aged me in 6 short months. I thought about my sister, her laughter, the scent of her favorite shampoo, the belief she once had that people could change. I wondered what she'd say now, if she'd forgive me, if she ever could. The night before sentencing, I went for a drive. Highway 120 stretched out empty ahead, almond trees flickering past in rows, memories careening alongside. I found myself at the edge of Lodi Lake just after dusk, the water dark and flat as stone. I sat on a bench and let the cold seep into my bones. I thought about Mike. If that was even his real name, somewhere his life ticking on, moving from job to job, his secrets a currency more valuable than money. I thought about Ramesh, about Jagninder, about how friendship can rot at the core before you even know it's sick. A family passed by, a father tossing his daughter into the air, her giggle carrying across the water. For a heartbeat, I let myself believe in forgiveness. Not from the law, or the families, or even my own blood, but from the person I used to be. The next day, I dressed the way my sister always said made me look strong. Boots, black jeans, her old bracelet. I went to the courthouse in Stockton, hands shaking. Reporters pressed, snapped photos. I kept my head down, eyes on the feet of the woman in front of me. Inside, the usual theater of grief and justice. Lawyers with files, bailiffs staring straight ahead, strangers taking notes on notepads. The prosecutor read out facts, dates, payments, betrayal. Each word felt both distant and razor-sharp. Jagninder testified, his voice flat and broken. Ramesh slumped in his chair beyond caring. When it was my turn, I stood and spoke simply. "I did what I did because I was desperate," I said. "But that doesn't make it right. My grief isn't an excuse. I'm sorry." The judge nodded, jotting notes. There was no grand gesture, no moment of cinematic forgiveness. The sentences were handed down, years and fines. And somewhere in the middle of all that, my life as I'd known it ended. When I walked outside, the air felt cleaner, emptied of secrets, washed by the knowledge that now, at least, nothing was hidden. In the months that followed, I learned how to be alone again. I cleaned apartments for a living, spent weekends volunteering at the rehab center where my sister once tried to claw her way out. I made my peace with small joys, hearing children laugh, smelling fresh bread, watching rain trace patterns on window glass. Grief, betrayal, guilt, they don't go away. But with time, they change color, fade at the edges, become easier to carry. I still talk to my sister at night, sometimes out loud, sometimes just in my head. I tell her everything, the things I did, the lines I crossed, the hope that someday she'd understand. If you think monsters look like something you'd know if you saw them, you're wrong. Sometimes they look just like you in the mirror, heart pounding, wishing for one more chance to do it all differently. But you don't get chances. Only consequences, only truth, only the long road back from the edge you never meant to cross. I'm still here. I'm still searching for forgiveness, for a life beyond the shadow of that parking lot. And if you're listening, if you think you'd never make the choices I made, remember how fast love can become desperation, and how easily even the best of us become someone we never thought we'd be.